It is Monday, February the 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. Coming up, Turkey extending strikes on Kurdish fighters in Syria, and U.S. High Court Justice Antonin Scalia dies.
He will go down in history as the foremost proponent of originalism as a method of constitutional interpretation.
Also ahead, a key decision by Egypt's High Court, plus the latest from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu, in a telephone talk with German Chancellor Angela Merkel on Sunday, said Turkey will continue to target U.S. allied Kurdish fighters on the Syrian frontier near its border, despite mounting international pressure on the Ankara government to stop it. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with Portland State University Middle East scholar Peter Bechtol, who says the shelling of Kurds by Turkey is complicating the already difficult situation in the region and explains the background to back up his point of view.
The background is that you have different players having different objectives. The United States wants to go after ISIS and Nusra. Turkey wants to go after the Kurdish group. The Russians want to go after the enemies of Assad. And so they keep calling each other names and say, you're not cooperating with our objectives. And they keep misrepresenting the objectives. That's really what's going on. So it's a continuation of what we've had the last, month, really. Every party is trying to maximize their position prior to the end of the fighting, which is supposedly going to be in a couple of days.
Well, the Kurds continue to advance, as do pro-Damascus forces in northern Syria. What are the Turks concerned about? Is it that the Kurds will carve out some sort of autonomous region in northern Syria?
Yes, and adjacent Turkey. Because from a Turkish point of view, and I think that much of the world looks at it this way, the borders that were drawn after World War I have not served people very well. The Turkish-Syrian border has been very, very controversial on both sides. Turkey feels that the Ottomans, lost the war, but the border should have been drawn much deeper into Iraq, especially, and in particular into Mosul, in order to prevent a Kurdish separatist movement. Because if there is a Kurdish separatist movement, it will take a quarter of southeastern Turkey. And so whenever there's a Kurdish organization that becomes armed, they're afraid, here they come, because this struggle has been going on since the 1920s. It may not have been on American radar screens, but it's been going on ever since. And the Syrians have been the northernmost Arabs in the Ottoman Empire since 1517. That's half a millennium ago. And so whenever there was any confrontation between the Ottoman Turks and Arabs much further south, it was the Syrians who took the brunt of the battle. And so of all the various Arab states, the modern states, the Syrians are the most anti-Turkish, and the Turks are the most are particularly anti-Syrian. They have much better relations with everybody else.
Well, this puts the United States in somewhat of a bind because of its good relations with Turkey, but also it is backing the Kurds in northern Syria.
Exactly. And it is backing them concretely. Not just rhetorically, but militarily, as far as we know. And for all I know, logistically as well. And the United States has apparently persuaded the government of Saudi Arabia to deploy some of its fighter aircraft to interdict Air Force Base, which has been a major NATO resource for several decades. And that's inside Turkey, to persuade them to have some skin in the game, as it were. And that is also a very serious matter, which I attribute. Now, this is just a very personal view, and that the United States governments and population, the part of the population that follows world affairs, must have been quite frustrated with Saudi actions in Yemen. And the Saudi actions in Yemen have been coordinated with the U.S. Military. You know, to say we're going to look the other way in Yemen if you help us in Syria. Because from a U.S. government point of view, the top threat is the Islamic State, you know, and the possibility of the Islamic State expanding.
Middle East scholar Peter Bechtol speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. On Sunday, Saudi Arabia confirmed it had sent aircraft to the NATO air base near the Syrian border in southern Turkey to step up operations against the Islamic State in Syria. On Saturday, Turkish Foreign Minister Melvin Cavusoglu said no decision had yet been made on a ground force against the Islamic State, which some analysts say could dangerously widen the multi-faction conflict and raise the specter of a Turkish clash with the Russians. U.S. officials say there is little to be done to counter militarily the Russian-backed Assad offensive, and they argue the vicious five-year-long civil war in Syria has left upwards of 250,000 dead. It won't be resolved by the clash of arms, but through a negotiated political settlement. And now a look at women and Muslim reform. My colleagues Carol Castiel and Eva Masrieva, a native of Indonesia, the largest Muslim nation in the world, who also is a broadcaster in VOA's Indonesian service, speak now with Azra Nomani. She's co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, a new initiative of Muslims, which they say advocates for peace, human rights, and secular governance. She discusses her message conveyed in a Washington Post opinion piece titled, "As Muslim Women, We Actually Ask You Not to Wear the Hijab in the Name of Interfaith Solidarity."
Our message is that the headscarf is not a pillar of Islam. The headscarf is not a requirement for Muslim women, and it is actually a symbol of an interpretation of Islam that is very political and that seeks to subordinate the role of women in society. And so what we're telling our fellow women out there in the world who think that they are supporting Muslim women by putting on a headscarf is that they are not. They are actually supporting an ideology that sexualizes us and subordinates us and subjugates us.
On the other hand, Asra, you're not saying to observant Muslim women who actually do see the headscarf as sort of part and parcel of their beliefs, you're not saying that they're misguided by wearing one.
What we're saying is that everybody has free choice, of course. Everybody has the right to wear a headscarf or not to wear a headscarf. That a Muslim woman is actually very observant, even when she does not wear a headscarf. And so what we are realizing is that in our Muslim communities around the world, there's either institutionalized forcing of the headscarf or there is shaming if women don't wear the headscarf. And what we're arguing is give women free will and free choice and respect all women for the choices that they make.
And what you're saying is there seems to be, to some extent, a misinterpretation. Define what hijab means to you and headscarf.
As you mentioned, Carol, I was born in India into a very conservative Muslim family. My mother wore the full-on face veil until my grandmother literally ripped it off of her face when my mother arrived at the railway station in Hyderabad, India, as a new bride. This is a cultural tradition that has been part of our Muslim communities for many generations. But what happened is that in 1979, with the Iranian Revolution and the exportation of a very strict interpretation of Islam from Saudi Arabia, this message got out that the headscarf was required. But in fact, in the 8 references that there are in the Quran of the word hijab, no reference ever talks to it as a headscarf. It's mentioned as a curtain or a partition, oftentimes symbolically, like a partition between you and heaven, between you and spiritual enlightenment. And so what has happened is these words in the Quran that have been used for very different purposes are being appropriated for the sake of sexualizing women, including that we have to be covered in order to be publicly mobile.
Well, Asra, let's talk about the Muslim reform movement that you are involved in. What are its objectives, goals, and how widespread is it?
We are Muslims from around the world who are just fed up of this ideology that's being imposed on our lives as correct Islam. What we are challenging is the idea that Islam endorses violence, that endorses violence against women or people who are, quote, non-believers. We are against the idea that you must have political governance with Islam. We are against the idea of social injustice. And what we are for is an Islam of peace, human rights, and secular governance. I bet, Eva, that that was the kind of Islam that your father taught you.
Yes, it is. It is. And that's why right now, this Islamic kind of law is also makes my non-Muslim friends is also insecure with their own identity. They don't even want to make friends with me because they're just afraid that they will also get into trouble if they hang out with me and go into the movie theater or ask me to join our marriage in the church. So it also makes my non-Muslim friends also become insecure about their own identity.
Yeah, and I feel like this battle that we're facing is what it is that makes people fearful of Muslims today.
Yes.
It's been our failure to challenge the extremist ideologies in a way that make people feel confident and secure in this world. And so there's all of this campaign about the so-called Islamophobia against Muslims. But I argue, and we argue in the Muslim Reform Movement, that we have to put forward the type of Islam that makes all people feel confident and secure and content. And that is what we're fighting for, so that it makes a secure universe for everyone.
Asra Namani is co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, is a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and author of the book Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She was speaking with my colleagues Carol Castiel and Eva Mazrieva. To hear more of their conversation, you can go to our website, voanews.com, and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition. Egypt's highest court on Sunday reversed a 15-year prison sentence handed down by a lower court to policeman Yasin Hatem in the death of protester Shama Sabak. She was struck with birdshot in January of 2015 during a match marking the fourth anniversary of the uprising that ousted longtime ruler Hosni Mubarak. The death in Cairo's Tahrir Square caused outrage in Egypt, and President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi promised justice. The officer will now be retried. Most policemen charged with protesters' deaths have been acquitted. Ballots are being counted from Sunday's presidential runoff election in the Central African Republic as the country seeks to end nearly 3 years of sectarian violence sparked by a coup by a Muslim-led rebel alliance. Two former prime ministers were vying for the top job, with the winner facing the daunting task of restoring peace and reuniting the nation. Bangui capital city resident Nali Dadzi says lots of people came out to cast ballots because everyone wants peace, she says, for things to get better. Anna said George Dologwele was the first round winner on December 30th, taking about 24% of the vote. He faced Faustine Arsange Touadera, who took nearly 20% in the first round. The violence in the former French colony between Muslim rebels and the Christian Balaka militia has killed thousands, and some half million have fled the country. Libya's new presidential council has offered a revised roster of names for a unity government as part of a UN-mediated plan to end nearly 5 years of chaos in that country. A list of 13 ministers and 5 ministers of state has been sent to the internationally recognized Libyan parliament in the east for approval. It rejected an earlier proposed lineup. unity plan was agreed to by representatives of the country's rival parliaments in December, but it has suffered some delays in opposition. There's growing concern the lack of agreement is helping fuel the rise of the Islamic State in Libya. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo briefly detained prominent opposition leader Martin Fayulu on Sunday, 2 days before a called general strike designed to pressure President Joseph Kabila to step down from office. Mr. Kabila is legally required to step aside in December after 15 years in power. Fayulu, president of the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party, was held briefly for incitement to public disorder. Citizens are being asked to stay home tomorrow to demand elections to be held within the constitutional deadline. Also in the news, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, the long-serving justice on the High Court, has died of natural causes. President Obama said he had a brilliant legal mind.
He influenced a generation of judges, lawyers, and students, and profoundly shaped the legal landscape. He will no doubt be remembered as one of the most consequential judges and thinkers to serve on the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia dedicated his life to the cornerstone of our democracy, the rule of law. Tonight, we honor his extraordinary service to our nation and remember one of the towering legal figures of our time.
The conservative Scalia was 79 years old when he died. He was appointed to the High Court by President Ronald Reagan in 1986. Chief Justice John Roberts, in confirming Scalia's death, called him an extraordinary individual and jurist admired, treasured by his colleagues. Georgetown University professor of constitutional law Randy Barnett knew Justice Scalia.
He will go down in history as the foremost a proponent of originalism as a method of constitutional interpretation, meaning the position that the meaning of the Constitution should remain the same until it's properly changed by amendment.
President Obama said he would honor his constitutional responsibility and nominate someone to replace Justice Scalia. That announcement was not well received among the Republican Party presidential candidates, who all said Mr. Obama should allow the next president to nominate a replacement after the presidential inauguration next January. U.S. Senate would be the constitutional or the congressional body to approve the next justice, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican, said he opposes President Obama nominating a replacement for Scalia and might, in fact, not schedule a vote on any nominee until next year. Professor Barnett tells VOA the decision about who the next justice of the Supreme Court would actually be rests with the nation's voters who will be choosing the next president.
I mean, one of the, I suppose, fortuitous aspects of this tragedy is that now this will be a subject of the next presidential election, which is what the Constitution contemplates it would be. It's a political question, who the president nominates, who gets to be the president who nominates, and now this will be the subject of the election. It would have been the subject of the election anyway, but this really focuses the mind of both the candidates and the voters, because there's a real vacancy that's going to have to be filled, not just a hypothetical one.
With Scalia, the conservatives on the court enjoyed a slim 5-4 majority, although Justice Anthony Kennedy occasionally voted with his more liberal colleagues, most notably on the recent case that made gay marriage legal in the United States. And we turn now to what's buzzing online, and specifically the latest on one YouTube celebrity. For that, we turn to International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Hi, G.
Hi, Steve. Her name is Michelle Phan, and I'm guessing you're not too familiar with her because she does makeup tutorials. She has been posting the videos on YouTube since 2006, and since then she uploaded more than 350 videos and received more than 1.1 billion views. She also has more than 8.3 million subscribers. Things have been pretty good for her, with the Forbes magazine picking her as one of the 30 most influential people under the age of 30 in January.
That's huge, G, but why did she make headlines this weekend?
Because of an article titled, Why Michelle Phan is Starting Over by Mashable. The starting over here is not about her YouTube career. Now, of course, she started out on YouTube, but after gaining a loyal following on there, she was able to build a beauty empire, if you will.
I got you. So tell us about a couple.
Sure. She has a lifestyle network called Icon and a beauty subscription service called Ipsy. She also partnered with L'Oreal to launch her own line of cosmetics called M. Now, the monthly subscription box Ipsy is doing okay, but M, the makeup line, is an utter failure. And the comment section on their Mashable's Facebook page reflects that.
Ouch! What did people write?
First of all, many comments by male readers were, "Who is that?" But many female readers shared their feedback on her makeup line. Here's an example. "I was not a fan of the M brand. Not impressed with the quality at all. Hope she can turn it around. Maybe she can have a chat with Sam and Nick over at Pixie Woo. Real Techniques seems to be doing well." So that comment is in relation to another YouTube account called Pixie Woo, run by two sisters, Samantha and Nicole. They created a makeup brush line, and that's doing really well, unlike Michelle Phan's company. The latest change is that she bought the company M from the makeup giant L'Oreal and is looking to revamp it the way she wants to. So as you can see, successful YouTubers make money not only from the AdSense, but also by utilizing their personal brand. Steve?
I got you, G. Thanks so much. That is our social media guru, G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists was able to find hundreds of nearby galaxies that had been hidden by the dust and stars of the Milky Way. This gave them some new insight into a mysterious astronomical anomaly some 150 million light years away. Writing in a new study, the group says a third of the 883 galaxies they found behind our home galaxy have never been seen before. The study's lead author, Lister Stavely-Smith, from the University of Western Australia, said that while the Milky Way itself is very beautiful and interesting, it completely blocks out the view of the more distant galaxies behind it. The scientists say their discovery may also help explain a phenomena called the Great Attractor, which is described as a region of space that seems to be pulling ours and hundreds of thousands of other galaxies toward it with a gravitational force that's tens of thousands of times more powerful than that of the entire Milky Way. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. You know, philanthropy has always been an integral part of country music, and when it comes to cancer awareness in that genre, Martina McBride has the front and center position. The iconic singer has recently announced an exciting new venture to empower families in their fight against cancer. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition Sarah Williams to discuss the details.
Nikki, tell us about this new initiative called Band Against Cancer.
Okay, so Band Against Cancer is a partnership with some heavy hitters, with Sarah Cannon, the Global Cancer Institute of Hospital Corporation of America, and the record label Big Label Machine Group, which has an incredible roster of artists, including Taylor Swift, Reba McEntire, Florida Georgia Line, Tim McGraw, Martina McBride, to name a few. So Martina McBride, along with several other high-profile country artists, no word yet as to who it will be, they will hit the road for the Sarah Cannon Tour. Details are still forthcoming, but right now we do know the tour will hit several cities across the U.S. and end in October, which is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Now, not only will these concerts help raise money for charitable organizations, cancer support organizations, but each concert is going to have special on-site activities so that attendees can also find ways to be a more active part of the Band Against Cancer movement, aside from just, you know, paying to go see a concert. And the objective, they say, is to bring together survivors and patients and families and friends and artists and music lovers and cancer experts and advocates in communities across the country in this fight against cancer. And through these various collective efforts, patients will ultimately access high-quality treatment and research options that are close to home where they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, will this initiative cover all kinds of cancer?
Well, the initiative initially will focus on those who will be fighting blood cancer, and then eventually will highlight other kinds of cancer as well.
Now, Martina had a huge song that was about fighting cancer.
Yes, yes, which is so appropriate why she's headlining this. The song is called I'm Gonna Love You Through It. It came out in 2011 off of her CD 11, and it's about a 38-year-old woman who is supported by her husband while battling breast cancer. It was nominated for a Grammy that year. It peaked at number 4 on the country singles chart, and it has really been a major anthem in the cancer fighting community. And Martina has participated in all kinds of events to raise awareness about this disease. So, and she says helping families who are facing cancer has always been a cause that is near and dear to her heart.
You can get more information about this initiative at bandagainstcancer.org. You can also hear Martina McBride and other great country artists on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. If you're on social media, feel free to connect with Nikki at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA _music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
She dropped the phone and burst into tears. The doctor just confirmed her fears. Her husband held it in and held her tight.
Yeah, that's a great song. That's one you should download or stream. You really should listen to the whole thing. Sorry we don't have time to do that, because we've got to quickly tell you that the BAFTAs, the British Academy Awards, handed out on Sunday, and Leonardo DiCaprio, that's it, he won Best Actor for The Revenant. That movie also got Best Picture over there, Brie Larson, Best Actress, Mark Rylance, Kate Winslet, Best Supporting Actors, amazing night for them. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Today is President's Day in the United States, when Americans pause to honor their national leaders, beginning with the first president, George Washington. From the time of his death in 1799, his birthday, February 22nd, was marked unofficially. It formally became a national holiday in 1885. Over time, Americans also began honoring another great leader, Abraham Lincoln, whose February 12th birthday falls near Washington's. Official recognition of the two began in 1971, with a day honoring all presidents every year on the third Monday of the month. Washington won lasting fame for leading Americans to victory in the War for Independence from Britain. His popularity was such that he could have made himself a king if he'd so chosen. Some of the officers in his army, impatient with the democratic process, urged him to do just that. "Banish these thoughts from your mind," Washington said, and issued a stern reprimand to those who made the suggestion. He ordered the army disbanded, resigned his commission as commander-in-chief, and retired to private life. At the time, America was a loose confederation of 13 states. Over the next 6 years, Americans struggled to devise an effective federal government, but one that left important powers to the states. Many Americans distrusted the idea of a central government and feared abuses of power by federal officials, especially the president. At this critical time, Washington was the one person who most Americans were willing to trust. He was the unopposed choice to be the nation's first president. When he took office, the United States had a constitution, but its government was not yet organized. When he stepped down, the U.S. was recognized by the world's major powers. Washington put the nation on a sound financial footing and created an effective military to protect America's expanding frontiers. In revolutionary France, democratic ideals gave way to turmoil, terror, and repression. But in the United States, under Washington's leadership, revolution produced stable, democratic, and lawful government. By leaving office voluntarily after 2 4-year terms, he set an important precedent for all future presidents. He also oversaw a peaceful transfer of power from one elected leader to another, a principle vital to democracy and an example for peoples around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.